Hey everyone, welcome to Coasters and Creators, the podcast. I'm your host, Aaron Johnston, and we talk growing your theme park focused brand across the socials. Each week we hear from influential creators as they give a behind the scenes look at what it takes to succeed in this ever growing and ever changing community. I recently had an opportunity to speak with Ted and Shane of the brand Parkeology. I guess to kind of go back in time for a minute, I used to run a Disney website called Disney Report. Boy, I wish I hadn't gotten rid of that URL. But that was from like 2006 to, I guess, almost 2015. And not to get too far off the subject, but I guess early 2000s, maybe even into the 90s, there was a really popular site called Drudge Report. And it always kind of fascinated me because it was the most like simplistic website you could possibly imagine. Ran by a guy named Matt Drudge. I think it's still around. I know it's changed hands over the years. It's not exactly what it once was. But anyway, so at the time, but Matt would take, you know, news articles that he found interesting and just literally have three columns of links to interesting news stories of the day. And I thought, well, maybe that would work for theme park news. And so that's what I did. Every day I just would watch RSS feeds and pull down article links that I found interesting, news, you know, a lot of blog posts then, because that was kind of the thing at the time. And then over, you know, at some point I kind of got bored with that and I started using Twitter more and thought, well, I could just get all the news I want from here much easier. What's the relevancy of my website? And that's when I kind of just said, okay, let's kind of put this on. I guess it wound up being permanent hiatus. But anyway, some of the blog posts or some of the articles I would link to were Parkeology articles. And I thought those guys did a great job and had kind of drifted away from reading some of their stuff in recent years. And then I caught them posting on Instagram and thought, oh, wow, these guys are still around. I went back and started reading some of their archives and realized they kind of approached Disney parks in the same way that I kind of like to, which is, you know, you don't take it too seriously. You don't take yourself too seriously. Maybe that's the better way to say that. It's not that their approach to theme parks isn't they don't take themselves too seriously. They just in general don't take themselves too seriously. And for some reason, those are the kind of people I really gravitate to because that's kind of who I try to be, even though I don't always pull it off. Anyway, I think you'll enjoy this interview with Ted and Shane. I really did. It was fun to connect with people that I had seen online for so many years, but really didn't know. So I kicked off the interview asking Shane about what Parkeology actually is. Let's hear what he had to say.
We have a lot of fondness for the nostalgia of Disney and a lot of interest in how they do things and really a ton of interest in really minute topics of discussion. In fact, just earlier today, we were having a pretty big conversation about the opening of Epcot Center TV special starring Danny Kaye, which it's like, who watches that kind of stuff today? But only people who are really obsessed with the history of Disney and the minutia of Disney would be interested in a cheesy television special from 1982. But yeah, so, and then I think the other aspect of our brand is that we don't take ourselves too seriously. I think, you know, we have all of this knowledge between the two of us and a lot of passion for it, but we also kind of have, hopefully, a bit of self-awareness about how ridiculous it can be in the grand scheme of things. You'll notice we talk about the Parkeology brand and how successful we are at building our brand. One of the core things we've managed to do throughout our entire time is that we never quite capitalize on any opportunity that's given us. So when you ask the question for an elevator pitch, we're totally unprepared for that. That's not going to be something.
So I was looking at the about section of Parkeology.com and says Parkeology began in 2009 with three simple ideas to explore ancient theme park ruins, uncover lost relics from the past, and geek out over the most obscure details. So that's probably a good summation of what Parkeology is. And hey, look, don't let Shane or Ted at any point in this interview undersell how big Parkeology is, because under accolades and recognition, I see The Wall Street Journal, the Chicago Tribune, CNN, Fox News, just to name a few. And if that wasn't enough to give you an idea of the impact of Parkeology, what if I told you they have been recognized on on Big 105.9 as well. So impressive stuff. Really, actually really impressive, to be honest with you. It really is. You know, one thing I've always tried to do with guests we've had on the show is talk about their story. Their theme park origin story is the best way to frame it. And I do that for a couple of reasons. One, I've always been fascinated by how unique and kind of deeply personal everybody's story is in relation to getting to an interest in theme parks. So that's part of it. The other thing is, I feel like even today, my interest in theme parks was really formed by those early visits and my early perceptions of what I thought a theme park was. And it turns out Ted's experience was kind of similar to mine in some ways. Let's hear what he had to say.
I happen to be, you know, nowadays I'm starting to feel old, but I happen to be born at the perfect time for a couple of big events. Like, I was 9 years old when Star Wars came out. And, you know, I saw it on my 9th birthday, and that was just like the perfect age for that. Same thing with Disney World opening up. It opened up when I was just a little baby, but by the time I was like 7 years old or so, my dad had a business trip down to Orlando, which at the time was, you know, nothing like Orlando is today. I'm surprised he even had a trip there because it really was, you know, a much, much smaller town. But somehow he ended up in some off time they had going to Disney World, I guess, because it was the big new thing. And I just very vividly remember him coming home and very excitedly, like, trying to explain this thing to our family, my brother, and my mom, and myself. And, you know, as a little kid, I couldn't process what he was talking about. I had never been to anything like that. You know, we had been to some, you know, regional amusement parks and so forth. But he's talking about, you know, haunted houses and this and that. And I mean, it, like, none of it made sense to me. But he put together a trip, and a year or so later, we went down there, and it was right after Pirates of the Caribbean had opened up. And he was trying to explain it to me, and all I could, I'm thinking, why would anybody want to do this? I mean, we're going to go, he's telling me, you go on this boat, and there's pirates, and there's skeletons, and they're shooting at you, and they're trying, you know, and I'm just terrified. I'm crying. I didn't want to go on it. And we got on it, and within like a minute, I somehow understood. And then I just wanted to go on it again and again. And it was just that idea of entering a movie, you know, of entering a fantasy world that was tangible and tactile. It just really resonated with me. Things that I really enjoyed at the time, like Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, which came out, you know, when I was a kid, or Alice in Wonderland, which my parents read to me as a kid. It was like, oh my God, this is now real. Like, I have entered this fantasy world, which is no longer on a screen or on a page. I can interact with it and touch it. And then from that day on, it was just, you know, I became obsessed with it.
So Ted mentioning Pirates of the Caribbean kind of jogged a memory for me. Growing up, we would watch the sing-along songs on VHS tape. And there was a Pirates of the Caribbean sequence. It would turn out to be the Disneyland version. I think growing up, I always just assumed it was the Disney World version because I wasn't that familiar with Disneyland. And I think for me, it was more not understanding that it was an attraction and you rode through it. It was more about, like, how did it fit into the, you know, Disney World as a whole. I didn't understand anything about, like, the differences between Epcot and Magic Kingdom at the time and kind of how do you get to this ride? What land is it in? I didn't understand any of that. And so it was very, very mysterious thing to me. But anyway, this is Shane talking about how he formed an interest in theme parks at an early age.
My interest in theme parks started through going to Disney World every year. And so it's sort of a family tradition, family vacation. We'd always drive down to Florida and end up staying or going to Disney one day a year, and sort of felt that was started off as a routine. But obviously, you know, my formative years grew up in the 80s, and it was a pretty exciting time for theme parks with the opening of Epcot, and that's, I think, what sort of made me fall in love with going to Disney, and continued that tradition like all the way through, you know, like into adulthood. So like, worked for a very small amount of time at the parks, right out of college. Had my honeymoon at Disney World. Now I've moved from the Midwest to Florida so I could be closer to the parks. So yeah, just sort of a lifelong thing. Yeah.
So once I kind of realized that Parkeology was a collaborative effort between Shane and Ted, the obvious question then was, how did that collaboration come about?
So Ted and I have been friends for a long time. Gosh, from back into the late 90s. We had met on an AOL chat board, believe it. I mean, this is, people don't even know what those are anymore, but AOL was an old internet provider.
Just a quick side note. I never met any like collaborative theme park friends on AOL.com, but I contend to this day that I did once speak to 90s, early 2000s celebrity Jessica Biel on AOL Instant Messenger. I am certain it was the real Jessica Biel, even though my wife contends that I've lost my mind. One of my best friends, I think, can back that up. Anyway, sorry. Back to Shane.
That was dedicated to this exact topic, just talking all about Disney World, about the different details and the history of it and so forth. So we were friends online for a long time, and the Parkeology blog started after I moved to Florida and was able to go to Disney more frequently. I just started saying, I'm going to use this as a place to just capture my thoughts or my observations. I went, and Ted, I wasn't doing that very long before, you know, Ted also came on board because we both have the same mindset when it comes to this kind of stuff. So, and we persisted that way for, I don't know, probably 5 years, maybe, just like us just writing about the things that interested us, making a lot of massive mistakes in how we marketed that, because we were really just sort of writing for our own interests. And
so before Shane goes into talking about their actual content, and Ted too, I wish I would have asked Shane and Ted about that collaborative effort and if there's ever any kind of friction between the two. I know for me, I always like to think of myself as a great collaborator, but everything I've become involved in, I kind of get like too invested in it. And my personality is such that I want to have like a really tight control over everything, and I want to make all the decisions. I'm not a great like just go along to get along kind of person. So, and I have collaborative stuff that I do with other people that's great, but it is something like it's always a struggle for me. Like, you know, am I asserting too much control here? I need to pull back and let other, you know, let the other people that I'm working with have their input and make sure they're just as valued as any opinion that I have. So I wonder if that's ever a struggle between Ted and Shane when it comes to Parkeology and kind of direction and content and, you know, the normal things that you encounter when you're tackling a creative endeavor. It doesn't sound like that's the case. Sounds like they're very much of one mindset, and that's probably why they've worked so well together for so many years. But I do wish I would have dug into that a little bit. Maybe we can on future episodes. Anyway, here is Ted and then Shane kind of going in depth about how they didn't really focus on trying to, you know, optimize their content early on.
So we put no thought into whether or not anybody cared about what we were writing about. No thought into the things that people might see that might want them to read it, like the headline. If you go back and look at our older Parkeology articles, a lot of the headlines are pretty much inscrutable. You won't be able to tell what the article's about because we're just trying to amuse ourselves.
I think it actually goes beyond that, Shane. I think we were, and in a certain way, there's a charm to this that I still hold on to. As Shane just said, we were writing just for our own interest. There was no big picture here of turning it into anything or anything else. It was just an outlet to share ideas. And as part of that, I don't know what the exact opposite of search engine optimization is. Did I say that right? I still messed that up. SEO. I don't know what the exact opposite of that is, but that's what we would do. So our headlines would be, you know, I'll give you my favorite example. This is, in many ways, this crystallizes our approach in a comedic and fumbling way. So Tokyo Disney Sea is a fantastic park, probably my favorite park. And one of the great rides there is Journey to the Center of the Earth. And I noticed on a visit that they had installed umbrella holders on the sides of the vehicles, which is a very Japanese kind of thing to do because the Japanese are very thoughtful and considerate, and guests are carrying umbrellas. And so they gave them a storage thing. So I wrote a little blog post about, hey, isn't it cool? They now have umbrella holders and they're really nicely themed. And here's a photo of it. Now, I think most blogs or people trying to get this out so people might find it would probably call that article something like umbrella holders now installed at Tokyo Disney Sea. We called it mustard application now easier than ever. Now, why? Because in our convoluted way of getting there, Rolls Royces have built-in umbrella holders. And there was an old ad for a fancy mustard called Grey Poupon that featured two Rolls Royces pulling up next to each other and one rich guy, like, you know, eating a shrimp cocktail or something in the back of his, limousine, looks over and rolls down the window and says, "Excuse me, do you have any Grey Poupon?" And because Rolls Royces and sharing mustard and some tenuous connection between umbrellas, the whole first part of the article talks about Rolls Royces and Grey Poupon before eventually getting to the umbrella holders. So anybody in the world who would ever, like, let's say there's eight people again out there, our same eight hardcore fans, and somebody does a little search in Google for umbrella holders on Tokyo Disney Sea, the one article in the world about that on Parkeology, they won't find because we've buried it behind mustard application. So, you know, we're not saying this is the way you should do this. In fact, it's absolutely the opposite. But it does represent who we are, which I think ultimately what I'm really saying is we do stuff out of passion because we find it funny. Most of the time when I'm writing something, I'm simply trying to make Shane laugh. It may end up that, oh, wow, look, you know, 20,000 people reacted to this tweet and that's awesome. But I wasn't ever trying to get 20,000 people to like it. I was trying to basically get one guy to like it.
So I completely feel what Ted is talking about. And it may actually be the main problem that this podcast is trying to solve from my perspective. A lot of what I want to do is, it's like my natural instinct is to produce something that I like. Most of the time, it's just something to make me laugh. And I want to say that I don't really care if anyone else finds it funny. The problem is the platforms we use, everybody we interact with in the community, it's hard to get away from the idea that the whole goal is to, you know, put out content that you get feedback on that people like. And a problem is kind of the same way with Shane and Ted, where they may find things funny or they may have like really, really, really niche interests. Then you kind of find this, you have this conflict between do I continue with, you know, doing things I like and just being okay with that? Or do I try to find some common ground between my interests and then, you know, more broad interests to try to drive engagement? So that's where you find yourself. It's easy to kind of start off with, and you'll hear Shane and Ted talk about it in just a second, where it is easy to begin that way, but it's almost natural instinct to want feedback and that, you know, almost that acceptance at some point.
Like, nobody wants to just keep doing something over and over and have nobody read it or see what you're doing. I mean, at some point, you feel like you're just shouting into the dark. So it is nice. It gives you that nice little feedback. It's nice when people respond to what you're writing or what you're putting on social media. And the inclination is that now people are listening. So you kind of want to keep giving them more of what you're about. And I think that something we've really focused on over the last year and a half, 2 years maybe, is trying to do more regular postings on social media. I say maybe I've like done it for the last 6 months. Ted kind of was carrying most of the load there for a while, but we've seen like our numbers grow, which is like, it's a fun thing to watch to see like, oh, more people are following us, more people are liking us. I don't think we're in it just to do that, but it is kind of a nice validation that makes people enjoy what we're putting out.
Yeah. When you're on the blog, it's just, you know, you might have some people leave responses. That's always nice, but there's really no metric to follow or understand how many people have actually seen this. There are some rudimentary ways to do it, but it very much feels like you've just sort of sent this thing out into the ether and maybe somebody sees it, maybe they don't. Whereas on, you know, social media, you know, it's instantaneous reaction. And, you know, that's like Shane said, that's not our goal, but, you know, we're humans and it's nice to feel like, oh, people have actually seen this and understand it. And, you know, that drives you to keep doing it.
So Shane and Ted are the first bloggers I've had on Coasters and Creators. And I kind of wanted to know in 2023, where does blogging kind of fit into their content strategy? And how does it work with and interact with the content they're producing on the socials?
The great thing about the blog is it's sort of a repository of all of these ideas and thoughts and silly stories and stuff over the years. And what we like about the blog is it's a sort of a permanent record of this stuff, whereas social media is, you know, it doesn't even last 30 seconds, so much 30 years. However, over time, I think we have shifted a bit more focus on new social media, especially in the last several years with a emphasis on it this year in particular. And it's not because we, you know, like it better. And in fact, in many ways, we probably do prefer the blog, but the blog goes months and at a time without updates because it's a lot more of a effort, let's say. And also the world has just shifted, you know, people's attention spans, even just in the last, heck, you know, you want to say the last 10 years or the last 15 years, but I mean, really, even in the last couple of years, you know, you can see a marked shift to, you know, people's attention spans. Like I guess what I'm saying here is we'll put together a blog post that, you know, might take us days to put together some of these things. And they're, you know, long and in some cases in depth. And, you know, there might be 8 people out there who really understand what we're trying to do and really appreciate it. Whereas on social media, it's little bites of nuggets of information that that people can enjoy. And so we've definitely shifted, you know, with some targets to grow some of the social media platforms.
So as Ted and Shane move away from just a focus on the blog to focus on some social media too, does that change their strategy? Does it change the goals? You know, on the blog, they just kind of post what they want to post, and that's kind of how it works. Social media, they're going to try to move toward growing based on what's popular, the content that's trending, that kind of thing.
Well, you have to make a choice. And Shane and I discuss this a lot, and I'll let him go on in further depth about it. But you have to make a choice. Are you going to pander to the what we would call the mainstream, and you know, and there's great amount of information out there that is all solid and good, but it's like you said, it all basically does the same thing. Like, hey, which is better, a Dole Whip or a churro or whatever? And that's easy to lock onto, and you'll drive numbers. But that just doesn't interest us, you know. So you have to decide: are you doing something that is because you're passionate about it and you love it, and you might have a unique take on it, or are you doing it just to, you know, to get views?
No, it's good. At the end of the day, I think we're happy if people find the stuff that we like or gain some sort of insight from our, you know, weird perspective of the world. I think that's kind of what we're in it for. It's not necessarily to like capture the biggest audience possible, but of the things that we're interested in, that audience is not going to be super large to begin with, right? Hopefully it's bigger than the 8 people Ted keeps talking about, but I think it's just about finding those like-minded people and joking around and just celebrating those things that we love.
So one of the things that's kind of tough for people like me who've been in the theme park community for a long time, it is those social media posts, especially on Instagram. Hey, did you know that there are, you know, utilidors underneath the Magic Kingdom? Those kind of posts. And even those things like that are very popular. For someone like me, they're very hard to participate in because it's a knowledge level of the Disney parks or theme parks in general that is so so beneath kind of the threshold that you get used to when you're, when you talk to people who love this stuff, very niche kind of understanding of certain things, that it's just hard to it's to the point you feel like you hurt your brand if you kind of participate in that. While at the same time, there's also the flip side of, you know, there are a lot of people who are following your brand maybe for the first time or following this community for the first time on a platform like Instagram that just, you know, they don't know this stuff. So it's completely legit content. And I asked Shane and Ted about that.
Yeah, I mean, you hit the nail on the head as to long conversations Shane and I have about exactly that. Things that we might never consider posting because it's beginner level. I mean, it's super, super obvious. And then to us, and then for some reason that it'll get posted and all of a sudden it'll have a huge reaction and people will love it and they'll respond to it. And it's a constant balancing act to say, like, well, how do we remain true to ourselves? Right. We don't want to put out there just repeat stuff that within our community would feel almost patronizing. But at the same time, some of our posts might reach a far wider audience than the proverbial 8 people who generally follow us. So, you know, how do you appeal to those people without insulting the more knowledgeable people?
They go on to talk about internally how they handle this, how they classify their different content types.
I'm going to give you a little insight to the our minds and, you know, something directly pertaining to what you're talking about. So at some point we realized exactly what you're talking about between a more mainstream post and a more niche that might actually be more interesting to us post. And we decided to sort of split our posts into 2 broad groups. One of them is just more of a general knowledge mainstream post, frankly, a little bit more pandering to a broader audience. And then the more niche posts, which we tend to balance, we try to do one of each a day, but sometimes it doesn't work out exactly like that. The more niche posts we call Ross, R-O-T-H, Ross.
It's the exact thing we were talking about with where our sensibilities lie. Roth is code name for J.D. Roth, who is the host of Walt Disney World Inside Out, which is an old Disney Channel show from late 90s. So basically, the idea is that nobody knows who J.D. Roth is, And so that's a perfect name for the, for these posts. If you know who J.D. Roth is, that post is probably targeted to you. So, and typically that's where our knowledge, like we're most excited about posting is that type of content.
Well, also the very first Roth post, or i.e. super niche insider post, was in fact about J.D. Roth.
So one thing I'm always interested in, I guess because I kind of struggle with it myself, is do creators know who their audience is and how much of a handle do they have on those demographics?
Our audience tends to be late middle-aged women. Now, I don't... I'm making that up. I don't know. It's Disney Plus fans that are obsessed with this stuff is ultimately what all of our metrics show us. It's tough to know, you know, there's the reach, which is who sees it, right? And then there's the audience of people that are actually engaging with it and want to see more of those types of contents, like the people that will follow you on social media, or people that will like you or subscribe on the blog. They definitely tend to be a niche group of just like super park fans. Like, we're not going to get the typical people who want to know, like, just how to plan a vacation to Disney World, you know, like how do I work the dining plan, or how, you know, what hotel has the best pool. We're not going to get that type of audience. We're only going to get the people that are really excited about the detailing and the history of it. And I think that's what, when something catches like that, that's I think what keeps us going. You know, we might have a post that could go, or tweet that goes to 70,000 people, and if it translates into people following us, then that's a successful post. If it just goes out to 70,000 people and, you know, they sort of like it and move on, then it's probably not our core type of content.
I think that we do, our audience realistically though does skew a little bit older, because so much of our content comes from our nostalgia and our experiences. You know, I worked at Disney World when I was 18 and 19. And that goes back to the 80s, right? We've been going there, in my case, since the 70s. So if you write about that stuff, it would be, you know, like, I can use my daughter, who's 18, as a barometer, you know, like, if I go back too far, she just has no idea what it's about. And it doesn't mean that she won't find it interesting, but it won't really resonate with her. However, if you're a 45-year-old guy and you remember, fill in the blanks back in 1986, I remember that, that stuff's going to resonate with you. So as much as we would love to have, you know, high school guys and, you know, be into following our content, the reality is, if you're being nostalgic about the 80s and 90s, you probably have to have lived through the 80s and 90s.
So I think the point that Ted is making here, and I think it's the most interesting thing for me, is that you really have to take a hard, realistic look at what you can do and who you can market to, based on some combination of who you are, what you enjoy, and the content that you produce. And that can be a depressing thing, a sad thing, if you let it. Maybe you want to be, let's just take me for example, maybe you sometimes want to be that guy straight out of college that can pull off some of the things you see on the socials. And it kind of is depressing that, no, you're a 40-year-old guy who simply cannot pull that off. And what you have to remember is that, you know, you still have other strengths. You still have other things that you can bring to the content that you produce that you wouldn't have been able to otherwise. So, you know, in Ted and Shane's case, theme park history is it's a niche market. And like Ted's saying, it's a demographic that has a shelf life, just like everything else. But when you're doing content that's based on something that's happened in the, you know, in the past, marketed to a specific demographic who experienced that in the past, you know, it has a very defined shelf life. And so that being said, what do you do to try to drive growth in that market?
So the past 6 months, we very specifically have been focusing on, you know, this is actually funny in its own right. It's sort of telling of how Parkeology works. We decided to focus on Twitter right before Elon Musk buys it and implodes the whole thing. So that's just sort of course that would happen if that's what we focus on. But it is interesting. When we started to focus on Twitter and started to try to crack the algorithm a little bit and what makes something successful or not successful in terms of a tweet, I think we've done a pretty good job. I mean, we you know, if you go back a year ago, we might be a quote successful tweet to us may have had a reach of, you know, several thousand people. And now we routinely can get 40, 50, 80, sometimes over 100,000 people, even over 200,000 people is, you know, within reach. And, you know, that's much, much, much larger, you know, exponentially larger than before we really started to try to understand the inner workings of why Twitter seems to push some posts and not others.
So one thing about coasters and creators, I really like to come out of every episode with some sort of actionable item with a takeaway for you. And so when Ted said, hey, we focused on Twitter as a strategy, I really wanted to know, you know, what did that actually mean?
You have to do it every day. You literally have to tweet. You know, they don't release anything. They don't tell you how the algorithm works. But I can tell you one thing. We have speculation about a lot of stuff, but one thing I know as a fact is you have to do it consistently. If you don't do it consistently, it really almost doesn't matter what you're posting or anything else. If you got to teach that algorithm that you're active and you're out there and you're actively participating in the community, and it will start pushing you if you do that.
So this is the first time, as I mentioned before, that we have a brand that's basically built around the idea of blogging on the show. And I hate saying bloggers because that just sounds, I don't know, something about that. But anyway, so I wanted to kind of talk a little bit because this is, you know, something I've done in the past. Sometimes it's like pulling teeth. And so I wanted to kind of commiserate with someone else that had done the same thing just for my own selfish desire. But here's Ted and Shane talking about kind of their process behind how they write posts for Parkeology.
It's a really complicated peer-reviewed submission process that I think our process is some goofy idea pops into your head and you sit down and write a thing about it. Shane has actually been kind of had a little streak going recently. I've not posted an actual blog post for a while. So why don't you tell him about the Jolly Wheeler, Shane, and what that process was about?
Yeah, so this isn't exactly typical. I'm watching some Epcot special and there's a flyover helicopter shot the United Kingdom Pavilion and World Showcase, and I see what looks like an abandoned dock on the waterfront of the United Kingdom behind the Rose and Crown Pub, and I think, what is that dock? And I ask Ted what it is, and he makes up some story about how there used to be a ship called the Jolly Wheeler that was out there that was in the early years of the park, and it was planned and everything, and they used to do little tours around the whole showcase and that thing. Turns out I was just Ted making all that up. There was no actual ship there. It looks like it's just an artifact left over from design that maybe at some point was intended to have a ship. But that's the sort of stuff that interests us. So it ended up as a blog post on the blog. That is literally what the blog is. We don't put, we're trying to write on the blog mainly to amuse ourselves and to talk about the things that interest us. But it's... I think we're a lot more deliberate in the social media content than we ever were with the blog content. Like, we never used to ask, does anybody care about this thing that I'm writing? Whereas we do try to, like we mentioned, the two categories on social media, we do try to think of things that other, like, that might have more mainstream appeal so that we can at least post something about that every day.
So I'm kind of following up with the same question that I have asked everyone that comes on the show. You know, where do you go from here? And here's what Ted and Shane had to say.
I think in typical archaeology fashion, our plans are very nebulous at this point about where we go from here. You know, we are both famous. We talk about many things, all the things you mentioned. We talk about a podcast or a YouTube channel or other park challenges or other things that we could do with the blog and so forth. And while we have all of these ideas, I mean, the key is that it takes time and it takes commitment to do all of them. So, you know, it's probably accurate to say that sometimes we just tend to fall back on what is easiest to just keep the ball rolling and not let things just totally die off. But I think it's also fair to say that who knows what the future might be. Like maybe we will at some point get really motivated by a new platform or a new idea and go off on that journey.
I do think that there are, you know, we do have some internal goals that Shane and I discuss amongst each other, and we're on target to reach those goals. These are things that are, the goals are currently more social media oriented. But I wouldn't be surprised if once we hit those goals that we don't kind of expand a little bit. You know, Shane is down in Florida. I live in Chicago. So if I was down there and able to go into the parks the way Shane is, and, you know, someday that may happen, I think you would see, you know, we would probably at that point shift gears and start doing a lot more, you know, vlog type of posting and head in that direction.
So anytime you get to talk to somebody like Ted and Shane who've been doing what they've been doing for a number of years now, I always have to ask, you know, what's the key to the drill? How do you keep going? What advice do you have for someone that wants to do the same thing?
It's literally just like with anything in the world, anything at all. You just have to do it, right? I mean, if you're going to ski down that hill, you can stand at the top of the mountain and discuss it and plot out your course and stuff all you want. But at some point, you've got to push yourself off the thing and ski down the hill. And you're going to fall and you're going to get up and you're going to make it down. And then you're going to understand, oh, that's what skiing's about. So the next time you do it, you're going to be a little bit better at it. We do it because it's something we enjoy and it's fun. But even if we had more grandiose plans about turning it into a real business and so forth, I really think the same parameters apply. It has to be something that you care about. If there's one thing that I've learned in life, you will always fail unless you are doing something that you care about, right? So if you said, hey, Ted, start blogging about, you know, Knott's Berry Farm, I would be better at that than the average person, but I ultimately don't really care about Knott's Berry Farm. So, you know, you got to do something you care about, and then you just have to do it, you know, and everything else just sort of falls into place.
So we've heard that advice before on Coasters and Creators. But I think it's good just to continue to remind that is probably the best advice you can give someone when it comes to, you know, pursuing something that you want to do. What's the saying? If you wait till you're good at something, you'll never do it. And I mean, that's been proven true in my case. I think about this podcast. When it first started, everything seems so big when you just first start down the road towards something you want to do. Like in this case, where do I host it? How do I get guests? But, you know, I mean, I've published podcast episodes. You can go out to Apple Podcasts and there is my name. There's the name of the show sitting in a library on Apple Podcasts. And I just thought that would never be possible. But it's just something that you have to just, like Ted was saying, you have to do. And then you have to remember that once you've done it, you know, when you want to pursue something else, you kind of have to remember or remind yourself that, you know, I've tackled something before that I didn't think I could do, and now I can. We ended talking about my favorite theme park subject, Epcot. So no one is, I mean, who else could be considered experts in the field of theme park history more so than Ted and Shane? And so I asked them what they thought about the current state of my favorite theme park, Epcot.
For years, I always thought of Epcot as this really weird cell, right? Like it's not at all like what Magic Kingdom is. It's not as focused in its theme as like what even Disney Imagine Studios was, or Animal Kingdom, where they have these very clear motifs that are going into the park. Epcot's a weird word made up by Walt Disney. It's kind of got two weird halves of the World Showcase and the Future World. It wasn't until I was like older that I kind of understood, oh yeah, that's sort of what World's Fair used to be. But to me, it was all a very, very unique concept to build a theme park around. And it's just not that anymore. It's much more like Magic Kingdom, where you see a lot more IP coming into it. They still try to, I think, pay a lot of lip service to the educational aspect of it. But it's not forward. It doesn't have that forward, futuristic vision of things. It's more of like, these are some entertaining stories that kind of fit into the pavilions that were already there.
Epcot to me, original Epcot, you know, holds an incredibly special place in my heart. Like I was saying, I was the perfect age for Star Wars. I was 9 years old. I was 14 when Epcot opened, and I was there at its opening. And I bought the Abrams book about Epcot, the real version of it, the big thick one that came out before Epcot opened that was just filled with concept art. And I had saved up money from like cutting lawns and stuff. And I bought that thing, which was like 40 or 50 bucks or something in like 1981. I mean, it's like it was a lot of money. And I just pored over that. To this day, that physical copy of that book, the book that I personally owned, is like one of my most valuable physical possessions. Because it represents such optimism and such excitement. And, you know, the Epcot that I still think of as Epcot is obviously gone. The weird ass kind of like Frankenstein together thing of, you know, the previous 10 years ago, 10 years past or so. That's a park that I really didn't recognize. And it was often depressing to me to go there and see just the weird state that it was in. I appreciate that they are at least on some level attempting to, you know, revive the park and have some kind of uniformity to it. But of course, you know, World Showcase is fine, but what was once Future World and really what I thought of Future World was always what I thought of as Epcot. You know, World Showcase, at some point in time, it flip-flopped, and World Showcase, you know, I think because people like to go there and get drunk, World Showcase somehow became like what people think of as Epcot. But to me, it'll always be Future World. And what's there now in Moana, you know, water parks and Guardians of the Galaxy and stuff, this stuff's all fine. I don't want to be the, you know, old guy screaming, get off my lawn. But it's just a shame that people today will just simply never be able to understand what that original Epcot was, what it represented, what it felt like to be there, how each of the pavilions worked in unison to create an overall picture. It was, you know what, maybe it can't exist outside of the 80s. I don't know.
This episode of Coasters and Creators is sponsored by me, Next Stop Aaron Travel Planning. If you're planning a theme park vacation to Disney World, Disneyland, Universal, Orlando, reach out to me at Next Stop Aaron on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, or visit nextstopaaron.com to let me help you book your next theme park vacation. So I hope you've enjoyed what Ted and Shane have shared and some of the kind of what they've been through, where they're going. Some of what they've learned. I think it's really neat to get to know these people, especially people that you see create content, do it for a long time, and just kind of do their own thing. Kind of that's just who they are. And I really appreciate that so much, and wish them nothing but success as they go forward.